All rise.
Thank you. You may be seated. So welcome back for our second oral argument of the afternoon. This is a criminal case. As you heard Judge Quisenberry or Judge Johnson, I can't remember which one, say that the first one was civil, just fights over money. The second one is criminal, fights over somebody's liberty. So I'll reintroduce the panel for those attorneys who might not have been here for the first argument. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Mike Wallach. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand the parties have checked in and are ready to begin, so I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call David Jackson versus the state of Texas. And please support Mr. Paul Blue will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Jeffrey Shell will argue for the state of Texas. Okay.
Mr. Blue? Okay.
Justices, may it please the court. First of all, not to waste my time, but I hope that you receive my courtesy briefs that I dropped off. I think I can combine, again, my name's Paul Blue. I represent David Lee Jackson. It's been probably 10 years since I've argued in Court of Appeals. So if I'm nervous, it's just the way things are. You know, deal with it as we deal with it. This is an appeal from the 271st District Court. I believe, for efficiency, I can combine points one and two, error, possibly. It's on my contention that the trial court abused their discretion in denying our motion to suppress, based on the fact that the officer, Chandler Works, had insufficient or non-articulable facts that developed any type of reasonable suspicion to pull Mr. Jackson over. As the testimony came out, Chandler Works was a corporal at the time with Wise County. He was on patrol, noticed a vehicle, right lane. He says one thing, the video, which does not purport to be the same testimony, says another. Mr. Works testified that he saw Mr. Jackson bouncing off the fog line. He was some point behind him, and at some point he looked and could see Mr. Jackson, although he was wearing sunglasses, and the uncontroverted testimony is he's blind in one eye. He could see him looking at him in the rearview mirror. Subsequently, Corporal Works got behind Mr. Jackson, noticed flapping tags. So he continued to follow him. He did not pull him over.
Temporary,
yes, that is right. Justice. And so part of the reason that I believe Mr. Works testified he pulled him over is he believed that is a violation of the Texas Administrative Code or Transportation Code. My research indicates that a fictitious tag, which is not the reason he pulled him over, is a violation of the Texas Administrative Code and Texas Transportation Code. However, it is not a violation to have a tag on top of another tag as long as you do not have dual registration.
Well, wouldn't it true that it's really what's in the officer's mind? And the officer thinks that there's a criminal violation being made, even if that officer ultimately may be found to be wrong, then that gives them the reasonable suspicion that they can stop. Do you agree with that or not?
I agree that is case law is purported, I disagree with that into the fact that, you know, it becomes an issue of what is a good faith exception. In this testimony, or in this case, Chandler Works testifies, according to the record, that he does not believe that there's a penalty or it's a criminal violation for that to occur. Now, again, that goes to his good faith belief he did not know the law at the time. But then you have to get into other reasonable, articulable facts.
Weren't both tags expired?
Your Honor, I can only speak to the one tag that was in front, and it was expired. Okay?
The one the officer could have seen.
Sir?
The one that was visible to the outside.
Yes, that is correct. Now, I believe Officer Works testified that he did not, he could not tell from driving beside him whether or not it was expired. And so after following him, as the state's brief will say, he noticed more articulable facts, yet they're not espoused in the brief, of what they are.
Now, let me stop there.
Yes, Justice.
You have what the officer is experiencing and sees, and what they testified was in their mind up until the point when the stop is made. That's what we're limited to as far as reasonable suspicion.
Right? That is correct.
And you have, the officer says on the record that I did not see the fact that it was expired at the time I made the stop, then that wasn't in his mind at the time. Is that, am I tracking there? Is that?
I believe you're safe to say that.
Yes. But you're saying that their position is that he's getting more articulable facts.
Yes.
Do you remember, did the officer ever actually testify that he realized that those tags were expired prior to the effectuation of the stop itself?
I do not remember, to be honest with you, Justice. No. I will tell you this. The officer did testify that he believed that he was bouncing off the fog line. There was no mention of him failure to maintain a lane, no investigation of intoxication. The mere reason he pulled him over was to check the validity of that tag. Yeah. And at that point, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I mean, it is a totality of circumstances test, isn't it?
It is, and if I could get into that to a little bit. So, Corporal Works, doing his things that he's entitled to do before Rodriguez, he asked for his proof of insurance. He was given that. He smelled no marijuana. He asked, did he have any warrants? He did not have any warrants. He asked for a driver's license. He had that. He had the valid information that police are allowed to inquire to develop, you know, just to make sure that we're in compliance. However, Corporal Works testified, although it's not amazingly in the state's brief, that he says, I'm only going to give you a warning for the tag. It is not fictitious, but I believe it's in violation of one of the codes. So I'm going to write you a warning. At that time, Corporal Works did not write the warning. He went back to his vehicle and tried to detain or to improperly detain the detention.
Well, didn't Corporal Works, after he said, I'm going to give you a warning, didn't he go back and have dispatch run Mr. Jackson's criminal history?
He did.
And that's when he discovered that Mr. Jackson had, rightly or wrongly, not been entirely forthcoming about his past.
Yes, Jess, and I believe in the brief it supports that he was only wrong about the year, not about the possession of marijuana. And I would like to note for the record, the police officers that had no indicia of marijuana smell. There was no paraphernalia.
But didn't Corporal Works also articulate, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that this is legitimate under the case law, that Mr. Jackson was very, very nervous, was smoking cigarettes, and just, that's enough, isn't it, to...
Well, Your Honor, I believe case law holds that nervousness alone is not sufficient for reasonable suspicion or probable cause. Neither would be smoking a cigarette nor looking somebody directly in the eye.
Of course, what the state's going to argue is that, and driving over a fog line one time by itself alone probably wouldn't be enough for an officer to pull somebody over.
Correct.
But if you aggregate all of that, then that amounts to, under the totality of the circumstances, reasonable suspicion.
Okay.
That makes it reasonable. That's going to be their argument.
Yes, and given that, I'd like to go on to the next point about it was unduly detained and that Corporal Works determined that he needed a canine officer. There was not one.
Let me stop you.
I'm sorry.
Because you actually started this, and then
I'm sorry.
And no, it's okay. You started it, and then one of us asked a question. I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So it sounded like what you were saying was once he gave him the indication it was only going to be a warning, that it became essentially, because he kept the stop going beyond that,
that made it then turn into, essentially, he's being held improperly. Is that
correct.
What you're saying?
I am arguing that's a prolonged detention.
Yeah, and so, you know, is it your position then that once he said, I'm just going to give you warnings, that he just had to let him go at that point?
No, he can still do ministerial tactics, but he cannot be dilatory in his actions. He cannot delay. He did not call for a canine until 14 minutes after the stop. Canine did not arrive until 26 minutes, I believe, after the stop. That's a totality of 40 minutes until the canine was even allowed to do the free air open sniff.
Well, and again, you know, we're not talking about reasonable suspicion to make a stop now. We're talking about whether or not it becomes unduly delayed. That becomes a totality of the circumstances as it does do. There's, you know, some courts might say that an hour and a half is too long. Some might say that less is unreasonable. But usually you have to just kind of aggregate it in the circumstances to figure out if the courts are saying it's appropriate.
Right. And I agree with that, Justice. However, I would also agree that under United States Rodriguez, there's no bright line, of course. But given the totality of the circumstances, when you review this, given the fact that, and it's in the record, so I believe I can argue this, the dog was retired for unreliability and was a short dog. That would follow into my third point of error. So, again, I believe a 40-minute plus the time it took to search is actually a prolonged detention under Rodriguez.
Now, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Because this is what Justice Kerr started, she was asking about. And
I yes.
It definitely factors into this.
Absolutely.
When you're trying to quantify the amount of time that makes it unduly reasonable, when he goes back and he's told, essentially, that the suspect is lying about his criminal history, does that not enable the officer then to essentially expand that amount of time under, at least make the expansion of time more reasonable?
You know, I could argue, Your Honor, that it could make it reasonable for them to expand that, but not to the point where it's so dilatory. And again, I would argue too, Your Honor, or your justices, that the date of the offense might be a mental error of an old man. It might be deceptive, but I would believe, I can't argue what I believe, but it would seems appropriate that if I was going to lie about my criminal record, I wouldn't lie about the year, I'd lie about the offense.
Well, wasn't Mr. Jackson 53 or something?
A hard 53, Your Honor.
Okay, I was going to say, you call 53 an old man?
Well, I don't mean to offend anybody. I'm 61, so I'm
Well, so I'd like for you to shift gears for a second because I think your third point is kind of the more interesting one. First, I'd like to get your take on how that was preserved, that the dog trespassed into the car by perhaps, although it's not really clear from the video, jumping up on the car and maybe sticking his nose mm-hmm. slightly into the windows.
May I address one point?
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure if it's proper. May I hand something to the
sure.
There is a
Is there something to prevent the state as well?
It's available to the state. It's a PDR from the case of the 14th Circuit
that's almost verbatim.
Yes. Well, they granted that PDR and they're having an oral argument in a month. As I
that I have both briefs, Your Honor. Yes.
Yeah,
I just wanted to say I'm going to get into the preservation of argument. But I wanted to preference that in that during the trial, I was not aware of any case law in Texas that prohibited the dog from our free air sniff from encroaching or doing that. Under Jardines, which I argued, and I'm down to 2 minutes, but it was more to the porch. Okay, so. If you go through the physical intrusion rule or the property approach, it was extended by the Idaho Supreme Court.
Which, of course, we're not bound by.
Which I argued at, and I was laughed out of court. And then all of a sudden it
I'm
becomes.
I'm not going to laugh at you.
Well, I appreciate that. But it becomes an issue we're persuasive, but it becomes an issue when the 14th Circuit has the Court of Appeals affirmed the motion for motion to suppress and then the state appeal. So it becomes an important issue, but it was decided, I believe, August 24th, sometime after my motion for a new trial was ruled upon. Getting to the preservation of error, Your Honor, I believe it says that during the trial, at some point when the evidence is admitted, and I believe I have that, it's in the appellate rules, that all I have to do is make an articulate argument, and I know that the state argues that it's an argument, not an objection, but all I have to do is give the trial court notice. I did that. Even though some of the evidence was admitted, I did receive an adverse ruling, and I was granted a 3823 instruction in the jury charge, as well as there had to be some decision or dissent in the jury, as there was an Allen charge given the next day. So my point is, I put the court on notice. There could be a limiting instruction such as a 3823. And to be honest, at the time, I had to make a decision whether I was going to make an Idaho Supreme Court, whether or not it was good faith extension. So at that time, that's when it hit.
Yeah. If I'm remembering correctly, there was not a written pretrial motion to suppress.
That is correct. It was an oral motion to suppress.
Oh, well, your time is up. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much.
Thank you, Jeff.
You'll get to come back, give the last word.
May it please the court. Counsel, Mr. Ballou.
Thank you.
Honored guests and those in the audience, I want to introduce myself. My name is Jeff Schell. I am a full-time appellate prosecutor and financial crimes prosecutor in Rockwall County, which is east of Dallas. By way of explanation, I'm here on behalf of the County Attorney's Office for Wise County, Texas. And as this court may very well be aware, sometimes jurisdictions of smaller capacities are not in a position, whether financially or for other reasons, to hire or keep a full-time appellate prosecutor. And it is for that reason that the elected county attorney asked me to present the oral argument here today on behalf of the state of Texas.
You're welcome, even though you're east of Dallas.
Yes, and well out of my normal jurisdiction. As Justice Walker knows, I was in Fort Worth last week on Tuesday for the same district attorney's office out of Wise County.
I'm starting to worry about the funding for prosecutors across the state.
Well, and you know, for those of you in the room, I can say as a 18-year plus prosecutor in Rockwall County that the state continues to have an issue sometimes with finding prosecutors and keeping them. So those of you that might be in the audience that are thinking about law school, I encourage you to go, and I encourage you to potentially consider a prosecutorial career. It has been certainly rewarding for me. With that said, let me just say that there are, of the three issues that are presented here today, first of all, there is no abuse of discretion in the denial of the motion to suppress. The officer testified that he saw two tags on the vehicle, and he was of the opinion, and he testified to this fact in trial, that there was only supposed to be one tag, not two, and certainly not one flapping that he can see as he pulls in behind Mr. Jackson's vehicle.
It's not there.
Yes.
I think just that in itself is sufficient for him for it to be reasonably suspicious.
I think it's in part, yes. Now, I say that in part because, as this court well knows, it's a totality of the circumstances test. He also testified that he saw this vehicle bouncing off the fog line, and he saw the driver looking at the officer as he's trying to initiate the traffic stop. He sees the defendant looking in the rearview mirror, seeing what this officer is doing behind him.
And do you think that that's not what most normal people would do?
Well, I think it's, well, if you're a, if you're part of the motoring public that is not committing an offense, yes. But this is something that the officer has to take into consideration. He has to take that into consideration because upon his experience, he's then formulating in his own mind, why is he looking at me in the back? And as a result of that driver inattention, he's bouncing off the fog line.
And to Justice Kerr's point,
yes,
had he not looked at him in the mirror, the officer might have thrown him his report that that was suspicious.
But
a cynic might say.
But when you combine the two facts, when you combine the fact that he's looking at the officer through the rearview mirror, and the officer's clearly making eye contact with him, and you combine that with the bouncing off the fog line, and then you see the two paper flapping tags, that in its totality gives the officer reasonable suspicion to initiate the traffic stop. And not only did the court hear that evidence and deny the oral motion to suppress, but he also put it in the jury charge. He put a 3823 jury instruction in the jury charge, and it's on page 94, and it continues on to page 95 of the clerk's record. So if there was a problem with the stop, you certainly have a jury that is equipped with an instruction, a 3823 instruction, that says on page 95, therefore, if you believe you have a reasonable doubt that the evidence in question was obtained in violation of any provision of the Constitution or laws of the state of Texas or of the Constitution or laws of the United States of America, then in such event, you will wholly disregard such evidence and not consider it as evidence whatsoever. This jury still found guilt, despite the trial judge's denial of the motion to suppress and the jury being instructed under 3823 that it could disregard that evidence, but it elected not to. So, 2 points here. Number one, no findings of fact or conclusions of law were requested by either party in this case. And as this court well knows, you have to imply any findings that support the trial court's ruling. So even if the judge was mistaken, the jury was not, and then more importantly, now that we're on appeal and there's no findings of fact, you can imply those findings under the applicable standard of review.
Well, a judge can't necessarily determine what facts and conclusions, factual conclusions, the jury made.
Correct.
Because the judge isn't sitting in the room with the jury as they deliver it.
We would hope not.
Yeah. Probably be a mistrial.
It would certainly be a mistrial in my experience.
That's right.
Yes. But I think what I'm trying to say is that of the procedural mechanisms that were in place during this trial, first you had an oral motion to suppress that, number one, the trial judge denied. Number two, you've got a jury that hears all of the evidence, goes to the jury room and says, in response to a 3823 instruction, we believe the evidence is sufficient. So there's your second one. And then even after the trial, either side could have requested findings, express written findings by the judge, and that was not done yet. So of the three procedural steps that you have in this case, I don't see how the appellant can prevail on issue number one. Let me address issue number two, because I know this is an important issue for practitioners throughout the state, post Rodriguez versus United States, out of the United States Supreme Court in 2015. Why is it allowable to extend the traffic stop beyond the investigation of the tape of the tags. And here's what allows the officer to develop the additional reasonable suspicion to extend the traffic stop beyond the traffic, extend the detention beyond the traffic stop. Three things. Number one, the facts of driving. The bouncing off the fog line is important, even though it was in part what led to the initiation of the traffic stop. Number two, the nervousness that this particular driver exhibits while the officer is making contact with him. The fact that he's smoking a cigarette almost impulsively is evidence of nervousness.
Well, what you said, pre-stop activity and post-stop activity, it's going back to that.
Absolutely, yes. Because, again, as this court knows, it's the totality of the circumstances. Do the totality of the circumstances add up to give a reasonable officer the belief that criminal activity is afoot? And it's a very low standard for reasonable suspicion. I want to give the court a citation that's not in our brief. It's the Johnson case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals of 2021. The citation is 622 Southwest 3rd, page 388, in which the court reasoned that unlike probable cause, reasonable suspicion is a very low hurdle. Low hurdle, those are the two keywords that the court points out. And it's a low hurdle because that's what reasonable suspicion is all about. That's the test.
Well, let's say that we agree with you on the first two issues. I'd like to hear your analysis of the third issue about
sure.
the dog presumably breaking the plane of the open window to get a good sniff inside the car and
yes.
alerted to the presence of drugs. So what's your best argument against the Houston Court of Appeals, the 14th decision in Oregon?
Okay. First of all, as I think I said a week ago, it's out of the 14th court and it's not binding on you all. It's not binding on this court even though it's a published opinion. Secondly, as this court already pointed out, the Court of Criminal Appeals has granted a petition for review in that case. And they're wanting to hear more about that situation. So to this extent, at this point in time, this is an unsettled legal question. And as an appellate practitioner, that scares me. Because I'm not in a position to say, well, the Houston court, the 14th court got it wrong, as opposed to this court getting it right or wrong. My position is this, and we've set this forth in our brief, and we've cited the McClintock case at 541 Southwest 3rd, page 65, footnote number one. That case, McClintock, the Court of Criminal Appeals, was addressing the dog coming onto the curtilage of a home. And I think the major important distinction between this case and the McClintock case is this. Homes and real property are treated differently than an automobile. The automobile has an exigent circumstances exception that this court, I know, is well aware of. And I think the trial court picked up on that. If the court wants to look at the comments, I've set forth those in a brief. The court was looking at it and said, well, this is out on the road. It's a public place. Why couldn't a dog trespass into a vehicle if it wanted to? Even if that's even a valid motion or a valid basis to suppress any evidence.
Well, now, is there any suggestion in the record that, because I know that, what was the man, the Fry? Who was the dog handler? Sorry. Can't remember his name, but
I can
as I recall, it doesn't matter. But as I recall, he testified that he did not direct the dog to jump on the car or stick its nose inside, assuming that it did.
Right.
So I guess dogs have free agency to some extent if the handler's not totally overpowering its will? I mean, would that be argument that...
I understand the court's question.
Right.
I'm
just trying to draw a distinction between the home and the vehicle and what dogs are allowed to do, drug dogs, within the bounds of the Fourth Amendment.
Right. And again, this is why this question is important, because it's unsettled after Rodriguez versus United States. And as our law continues to evolve, and as our law continues to develop, we have to address these situations with the articulable understanding that a drug dog that's called to a traffic stop is on a public place. It's in a place that is unlike a home, which would be very unique and specific to me, any three of you, any of the people in the courtroom. A home is something that is very personal and very
what if somebody's driving their and living in their mobile home? I know that's not our facts. I'm just curious if that would factor into the analysis. If a vehicle is one's home.
Sure. And you very well might have a reasonable expectation of privacy to the cartilage and the interior of a mobile home.
Well, and let me stop you there.
Sure.
That was my question.
Yeah.
Are you telling us that the individuals do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their vehicles?
No, they do.
And if you concede that, I think the point is not that it's the cartilage of the exterior. Essentially, the allegation is that the dog was poking its nose through the plane, through the threshold,
yes,
into the car.
Yes.
That's where they're going with this. And so, under some circumstances, a person can still have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that vehicle.
Yes.
You can see that.
Yes.
But from a practical standpoint, how do we know that whatever it was that triggered the dog's response was something he smelled as he's moving forward to the edge of the window, 2 inches past the edge of the window, or as he's coming out the window?
We wouldn't know that.
We could ask him.
I mean, we could learn to speak dog and maybe articulate something to that effect, but unfortunately we can't. And so when you're in that situation, then that goes to the weight of the evidence. Maybe not necessarily the admissibility, which is what I hear Mr. Ballou saying. He's saying, well, there was a trespass, and therefore if there's a trespass and it violates a constitutional right of privacy to Mr. Jackson's interior of his own vehicle, then there's been a violation of the law. But without further specificity as to whether the dog was alerting by the trespass or before the trespass or after the trespass, the dog still alerts. And the methamphetamine that is found in that container right between the driver and the passenger seat. We all lean our arms in when we're driving over from Rockwell.
Well, does the Constitution give someone an expectation of privacy to contraband?
No. No, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy to be transporting more than 4 grams and less than 200 grams of methamphetamine in your vehicle.
Well, you have a reasonable expectation for privacy in a container that may later be found to have contained contraband. Obviously, I mean, those types of situations are suppressed all the time.
Yes.
If law enforcement seizes something, it might be illegal in nature, but they didn't have a legal reason to search that particular chattel or device or whatever it might be in which that contraband is found.
Sure, but the dog is... Rodriguez makes clear that the dog sniff is not a search for purposes of Fourth Amendment.
Let me stop you real quick, because I just want to clarify. Are you conceding that, I mean, okay, there's a sniff, and then there's the breaking of the plane, if you know. There's the penetration of the car.
Okay.
Are you conceding that the dog actually penetrated the threshold and actually essentially went into the bid.
No, I'm not conceding that.
Okay.
Because there was no basis upon which this trial judge could have made that determination.
Yes.
And I think the trial court said it. You couldn't tell from the videos.
Correct. Right? And so what you have is an unpreserved argument, objection, however you want to classify it. You still don't have a finding of any kind from this trial judge that determined that there was a trespass in the first place.
So whose burden was it to either prove or disprove that fact?
Well, I think it's the appellant's burden on appeal.
Who was it, the trial court?
Well, I think it still falls on the defendant. If the defendant is alleging that this was a violation of some constitutional provision, then where is it in this record that they brought this to the attention of the trial court judge and preserved error for purposes of this court hearing it?
Yeah, counsel, real quick. Now, on a motion to suppress, if I could be wrong about this, but the defendant files it.
Yes.
If it's a warrantless arrest.
Yes.
And they essentially allege that, then the burden shifts to the state at that point.
Correct. But that's not the facts here. And to Judge Kerr's point, this is how you get around the 14th Court in its opinion. This issue was just simply not preserved for appeal. And so this court could come to its own independent conclusion on the trespass issue without having to wait for the 14th Court to its opinion to be decided. You can still, as a panel, decide this case and affirm the trial court's final judgment of conviction because it wasn't preserved. I see I'm out of time. I want to thank the court for the opportunity to be here and thank all the people that were here in Parker County that made this very argument possible. It's truly a joy to be in other places.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw.
Counsel.
Mr. Blue?
Thank you. I wish I'd asked for more time, you know, but I'm going to talk fast. In response to one of your questions, Justice, does the public have a right to contraband? No, what we have is a right to unreasonable search and seizure. Okay. Real quick, too, this court in the Second Court of Appeals, McQuarters versus State, 583 Southwest 3rd, 250 and 257, has said nervousness in itself is a weak indicator of hidden narcotics. Part of the reasonable suspicion and things we were talking about were nervousness and wrong about the criminal history. Those are only two articulable facts that were presented for the detention.
Now, it was the trial court, essentially, even though the suppression was carried through the trial.
Correct.
The judge denied it.
Correct.
And there was no findings of fact and conclusions of law. And so you can see the state's position, and I think it can be the law, that even if the trial judge said, you know what, I'm not going to even consider that factor, but I'm going to consider these other two, the trial court could do that in determining, under totality of the circumstances, that stop was reasonable.
Yes, sir. I believe each case is different. And I would like to, I'm sorry I'm jumping around, but I would like to clarify. Judge Smith did go on the record while the video, and I implore you to watch the video, the appellant never touched the fog line. It was blown up on the big screen. I approached. I could put my finger in between where he testified that he could see him on the fog line. That is very blatant. The video does not lie. Eyewitness testimony is the least reliable, and we know that.
Were there any allegations that the camera didn't come on until after that had taken place?
Not to my knowledge, no. And I would like to clarify, too, my co-counsel over there did look through the record. Corporal Works did testify several times that he only learned that the temporary tag was expired after the initial stop. And I believe you had asked me about that. The other thing I would like to get into the totality of circumstances is I passed a DPS officer on the side of the road, and just given by my experience, I didn't know whether to wave to him or look away. Because, again, I don't know if that's reasonable suspicion that I looked away or that I waved at him. And again, it's a totality of the circumstances. What I would ask this court in closing is please do not let the ends justify the means. Just because the methamphetamine was taken off the street does not mean that it was an illegal or a prolonged detention or that the dog committed a trespass. And I believe it was the Jones case, U.S. versus Jones, that applied the trespass principle to the police GPS card. And what Judge Smith testified to, he did not testify or he did not comment on the fact that he could not see the dog touch or significantly break the plane. Now, to me, again, not to be funny, that's either pregnant or not. The video can show that the dog's nose clearly, in the testimony of Chandler Work, says the dog jumped up, took a smell, and then he hit.
I mean, from the camera, though.
Yes.
You can't see the window. It's the way the car's angling, you can see the dog standing. You can assume he's touching the car, but you can't see his nose going through the plane. Do you agree with that?
What I saw was the
dog. You can only see his nose.
You can only see his nose, but the window is open according to Chandler Works' testimony. The passenger window was closed.
You have to do some math to get there.
You have to do some math, but even a break of the plane under the Supreme Court of Idaho and the Oregon case, and I would like to bring the attention, this case is so important that they brought down Washington, D.C. lawyers to argue that in the PDR. And in getting to the waiver, I found what I was looking for. An objection is timely if it's made as soon as the grounds for the objection becomes apparent or as soon as the attorney knows or should have known that an error has occurred, and that's Neal versus State. If the objection is to evidence, the objection must be made at the time the evidence is admitted, which I submit as what I did at that time when it was admitted.
Well, which evidence? I mean, because...
The evidence about the dog sticking his nose.
But before that, the previous day of trial, the evidence came in, as I recall, unobjected to, about what was discovered. Like the methamphetamine, the baggies, the photographs, and all that kind of stuff was already in evidence, wasn't it?
I believe it was. Okay. Yes. Point.
Yep. Sorry.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well,
thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
It's a very good learning experience. Thank you.
Well, all right. Well, we enjoyed the oral argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, your case is submitted.